Viralcast, MovieViral.com's official podcast. I'm Dan, the executive editor for the site. I'm here today with Scott, the contributing editor and graphic designer for the site. And a very special guest, we have Mike Manello, who is the founding partner and executive creative director of Campfire. They are a company that pretty much just does what we cover. They do viral campaigns and such for TV shows such as True Blood, and they did one of the big movies that we know of, Blair Witch. So thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So I know I pretty much butchered what you guys do, but why don't you go ahead and try to explain kind of what the things that you guys do there.
Well, you know, the name of our company is Campfire, and that was to reference the oral tradition in storytelling, where, you know, stories were a bit of performance, and people would tell stories, other people would listen to stories, and then, you know, they would go to other campfires and tell those versions of the stories. And so that's how you know, many of the great stories that we know spread, similar to folk music. And and so we do that for entertainment companies, which we've done it for television shows, we've done it for movies, and we've done it for video games, and we do it for brands. So we've done big campaigns for like a car for Audi. We did an alternate reality game called Art of the Heist, and we do other work for Verizon, for Snapple. So so we kind of we do both. We kind of cross from movies into brand work. Yeah, but storytelling is really at the heart of everything we do.
Right, because I think that's for us, for a lot of our readers know, that's kind of the thing that we really, you know, there's all types of, you know, what people might call viral, but the thing that we tend to focus on and that we care about the most are those kind of things where they're telling a story while also trying to promote something. And it's a great way of kind of mixing the two. And it's always there's always, you know, more and more innovative ways that you're able to do it, of course.
Right. Yes, I mean...
Yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry, Mike.
No, you know, we relate to the world around us through stories, and it is the most powerful form of communication. I think that one of the things that with all these new tools and platforms online that we have is we have this ability to tell stories in a very unique way, you know, and to take it almost back to the realm of performance, where, you know, I think for the longest time stories used to be stories became static as we had books and we have radio dramas, we have movies and television shows. It became something you manufacture and then put out there and people watch. And we have this ability now to go back into the world of performance where stories are alive and people participate, and their participation can change the story.
Definitely.
That was the thing I was going to ask you too, is because you go in and you create these, you know, stories for your leading up to it. How much of that do you, I guess you stop creating and almost put it in the hands of, you know, the fans, the readers and whatnot to add to that and look for their own stories?
You know, it's what I like to say is that I think one of the big secrets of this kind of work is that as a storyteller, we have a lot more control over the story than most people like to admit, or that's commonly acknowledged. I know a lot of people like to tell the story of, oh, you know, fans come in and they change the story, and they do. But generally speaking, when you're telling a story, if it's designed properly, if your program, I use the word program rather than campaign, because I think that it's good to think about them as something that live on for a long time. I think that's, you know, they should often live longer than just one movie. Or, but you know, when you design a program like that, you know, usually what you should be doing is you should be thinking of the audience as having a role in the story, and that's a form of organization. Instead of telling people, here's what you're going to do, right? If you just create the role for them in your story, 99% of the people are going to come in and they're going to play that role, and they're not going to feel like they're playing a role. They're kind of picking up your cues and running with it. And so I often tell people that it's rare that I'm surprised where an audience takes something or where an audience pushes you. I'm often surprised about how they get there. You know? And but I'm rarely surprised. It happens, but not too often.
All right, and so you know, this is the 10-year anniversary actually of Blair Witch Project coming out, which was a big phenomenon for many reasons. One of them is the fact that it has that very unique style of filmmaking that ends up being very kind of almost spoofed to a certain degree, where people are doing it all the time now. Cloverfield is a great example of that actually being done successfully. But one of the other things about it was the viral campaign, where you had everyone believing it was real, but then you guys, we were just talking before this about how you guys didn't even, technically, you weren't even trying to push that. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think Blair Witch is a bit unique because it was the online experience was created by us, the producers and directors and writers of the film. So it was done independently, just as the film was. And when we were doing it, we weren't really looking at it as marketing, you know, which is significant, because when you put something out there, when most of these things are for marketing a film, and so there's a separation between the people who are making the film and then the people who are making the marketing campaign.
Right.
And the people who are making the marketing campaign have certain goals they have to meet. You know, they need to make a certain number of people aware of when the film's coming out and whatnot. Whereas for us, most of what happened with Blair Witch Online actually happened before the film was finished, and then it happened when there was no film to go see because we hadn't sold it yet. You know, basically a lot of the kind of story that unfolded and was created live happened between, you know, the summer of 1998 and January of 1999 when we were finishing the film. We premiered it in January of 1999 at Sundance Film Festival, and that's when Artisan bought it. And then BlairWitch.com was kind of reset, and the campaign, the story, was started over on a larger scale with a nicer website from January 99 or from February 99 up until July 99 when the film was actually released. And the website for our company, Hacks.com, was where we continued to release more information for the people who were following it the first time. So we kind of, in a way, had these two layers of story going on, which was people who discovered it and found it and were a part of it before we even finished the film, and then another layer, which was a more mass layer, that that people were rediscovering it. So in a way, we had a chance to actually do the campaign twice.
Right. Wow. Yeah, they have.
But to go back to your question, sorry. The difference is that when the story was developing and when the experience online was developing, it didn't really have marketing goals attached to it. It was much more about, we have this story, we have people who are into our story, isn't that cool? We're storytellers, so let's have fun with this.
Right.
And so in that sense, and because we were controlling both the movie and the website, we had complete control to really truly integrate the website and what was happening with the website with the film and the other pieces.
Yeah, that must make it a lot easier.
Infinitely easier. And I think a better experience for people overall.
Yeah, and so one of the things with the movie, you know, we mentioned the fact that people kind of believed it was real, even though it wasn't. You know, for one of the things that makes it so, made it such a common occurrence where people were believing that was because of the internet. And I think it was one of the first films that really, truly used the internet in that kind of viral sense. To the point where it wasn't even the movie doing it; it was the people that just kind of heard about it, and they were trying to, promote the film and or themselves, which is exactly what virals intended to do. And I, for me personally, it scared me because the movie takes place about 20 minutes away from where I grew up. So for you making, like a site like that, and that is that something that you try to anticipate? Is, you know, how are people going to interact with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're designing a program like this, now Blair Witch was a little bit different because I think Blair Witch happened very organically, and we had a small audience. You know, in January 99, we had maybe 1,000 people at the time who were really paying attention to us when we were kind of building everything and kind of inventing it and creating it and going along and figuring it out. You know, on the second time, we were kind of repeating what had worked the first time. So, but in that stage, I think we were thinking about it, but it was also very, very much alive in that, you know, we put what we had created and then people started talking and speculating about aspects of the mythology. And as they started talking and speculating and showed interest in it, we would kind of build it out and make it, you know, make that piece a little bit stronger and create more media to fill out that part of the story based on where people are going. And then when people started making up their own pieces or speculating that, you know, we were able to kind of incorporate some of that. But it wasn't really as well planned out as something that we do for an entertainment property today, like in the case of True Blood, where not only do you think about how the website is going to be perceived and how people are going to take it, but you think about every single little piece and what role it plays in the overall program. So, you know, in the case of True Blood, where we sent, you know, we started that campaign off by sending out these very strange mailers to people that were written in dead languages. And they were written in dead languages because vampires are eternal. So you go like, well, if you're an eternal creature, certainly you would know someone who could read, you know, Babylonian. And so it was about vampires communicating with other vampires in that story. And that's how we kicked it off. And, you know, you have to, you know, you take a look at something like that and you want to make it intriguing and you want to make it interesting and you want to make people curious about it. But you don't want to scare people. You don't want to terrify them into thinking that they got something evil in the mail, you know, or for real or something like that. So you're constantly walking that line and looking at each piece and kind of having to look at it both from how does it fit into the program and then how does this work if I'm coming to this cold and I just see this.
Right. And it's, you know, I'm looking at it too, like you had said, that with the Blair Witch, everything's kind of being pieced on top of each other. You create what you can, build up from what others are saying, and then go from there. Is it part to where you're actually learning, I don't want to say mistakes or anything, but you learn from mistakes of what you've done in the past and say, okay, I know we've done that before, so this is what's going to happen. So you kind of catch yourself as you go on.
Well, you know, I think there's, you know, what's really what I love about this field is that the history is recent for it, and that means there's so much room for experimentation. So I think we definitely make mistakes, and I think I would say 90% of those mistakes are probably never even noticed by people who are experiencing it. They're things that we know because we tried to do something and it didn't come off. And I think maybe to people who are experiencing these things, they don't necessarily pick up those cues, which is one of the reasons why it didn't work.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
What I think we're doing more of is building on what we learn each time out. So, you know, each time we do something, it gets better and it gets stronger and it gets more refined. So, you know, I think we can see from early days and sending things out to people and trying to incorporate real life events and how it's become more refined and we've become better at understanding what works in these situations and what doesn't. You know, and then we can, and so once we get that understanding under our belt, it gives us the freedom, because now we have the free time to think about something new that we've never done before and add that to the mix. You know?
Do you do that? I mean, as far as basically learning from mistakes, do you kind of treat that as and learn from others' mistakes and look at other companies and look at other marketing, you know, campaigns that have gone on and say, well, the feedback from this went this way, so let's not go that route when we do our next, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's yes and no. I mean, I think I try to pay attention to other work as much as possible, but at the same time, I'm one of those people that's like, I actually don't pull a lot of inspiration from the advertising and marketing business. I tend to, you know, when I'm not actually working on something, I tend to be more immersed into music or the actual movies or, you know, books or some other media. I tend to draw my inspiration from, you know, like recently I've been thinking about that band, The Flaming Lips, and there's so many things that they do that I think inspire some of the stuff we've done. Mm-hmm. I would almost say that, you know, in the case of some of our programs, I think my experiences with The Flaming Lips have shaped, you know, and what they've done have shaped the work that we've done more than, say, other viral work itself, you know, but that's just me. I think that happens a lot. I think you talk to musicians who play a certain genre of music and often their favorite artists are not within that genre, you know?
Yeah.
I think that happens a lot. So I do pay attention, but it's hard to learn from mistakes, I think, because it's interesting from day one, which for me started with Blair Witch in terms of doing this kind of storytelling online and marketing. From day one, I think whenever I've read the outside point of view or outside opinion about how something went and what the effect was, it's usually wrong from my perspective as an insider. And so when I read commentary or wrap up articles about things, whether it's an ad age or wherever, I sit there and I take it like that's this person's experience, or that's what this person got from interviewing us, a group of people. Mm-hmm. So I can go to communities that are following virals, for instance, and I can see one community is not liking it at all. And then I'll go to another community and I'll see that they're loving it, you know? And if you only find one community that's hating it, then you might think there was actually a mistake going on, when in reality, I've just stumbled across somebody who didn't particularly like that thing. So sure. It's really hard to kind of backwards engineer without being able to talk to the people who were actually making it right. About what really went wrong and what really went right.
And there's definitely the factor that, you know, each one of these things is its own creature, because you're basing it off of whatever movie or television, whatever it is that you're trying to promote, that's what you're basing it off of. So yeah, there's certain solid things that you definitely don't want to do, maybe, but you still have to realize that you have a certain audience, a certain potential audience that you're really you have to look at that more than anything else.
Yeah, I like to think of this kind of work as being handmade. You know, it's like you mentioned earlier that there are certain kind of virals that are not necessarily the storytelling, right? Like right. We think about things like Elf Yourself, mm-hmm. You know, and mm-hmm. How many times have we seen that as a viral promoting a movie or a TV show or whatever, where you put your face on something and then it makes a video, or it turns you into The Simpsons, right? And that kind of thing becomes a formula where, you know, you can probably point to anywhere from 10 to 100 of those things that are basically copies, just changing what it is you're turning yourself into, you know, like insert yourself in the trailer, and it started with Wedding Crashers, and then you saw insert yourself in this, insert yourself in that, and those things are copied. Whereas these things, you can't really copy them, mm-hmm. You know? It's like we were talking about the Follow the White Rabbit thing. It would be ridiculous to try to copy, let's put a bunch of rabbits in suits. It'd be like, well, how does that relate to, you know, this thing we're promoting? So in a way, you have to kind of create it from scratch every time, at least if you're going to be true to the entertainment property that you're promoting.
Yeah, definitely. Do you see that, you know, so you were saying some of these things, like where you put your face in something. One of the things we've been talking about lately is augmented reality. Do you see that potentially playing a role in storytelling of viral? That's something that I've kind of thought would be an interesting way of integrating it, because you see a lot where, you know, you put up your Coke can to the screen and then you can see, you know, oh, it becomes a spaceship from the movie, or, you know, things like that. But, you know, yeah. And it's like one-off things and they're kind of fun, but, you know, things like that, like the augmented reality or other things that are more kind of abstract but still using newer technology, do you think that those kind of things, other than just creating websites or, you know, mailing people stuff or seeing people outside, do you think some of the more new technologies might be able to be kind of folded into the storytelling?
Yeah, I think they will. You know, I think the key and the difficult thing is that, you know, I always look at things and I go, we can do anything. The question is whether we should do that thing. And what I would say is, like, when I often see mistakes, and I think sometimes we've even been guilty of it, is where there's this shiny new object and everybody's in love with it, like augmented reality, and so you kind of want to use it, and so you just kind of think of a way to use it. And I think that, you know, in a well-constructed program, if you were going to use augmented reality, it would serve a real unique purpose, and it wouldn't just be a bell and a whistle, you know, like a little thing that's added on. I mean, I think what I've seen so far to me has been like that. It's been this little kind of, it's been relying on the wow factor, where you go like, wow, that's cool. And then it's like, okay, I'm done with that. You know, like for all that I thought was great about the District 9 campaign, when I printed up that target for the augmented reality thing and I held it up and I was just like, oh my God, this is the most boring thing ever. I'd rather click on a 3D model and navigate it that way, you know? It just seemed like somebody somewhere said, let's use augmented reality, and then they figured that out. And, you know, where I see the potential for augmented reality is maybe in, you know, what I'd like to see is maybe connecting it to mobile devices or using it for a storytelling. You know, there's an iPhone app called The Hidden Park, mm-hmm. that I think is really interesting, and it allows you to tell a story in a physical location like a park, and it's geared towards families and kids. But I look at that and I go, now that's really cool, right? Like if there was an experience where I'm out and about, and then I had this app, and I could hold it up and look at something, and I could start to see, you know, you'd need a specific kind of story, but all of a sudden I could kind of have a story start to unfold wherever I am, and it would take in the things that are around me. I think that starts to get really interesting to me. Or if you could figure out a way to use augmented reality in a way that allows audiences to communicate with each other through augmented reality rather than a solitary thing of me in front of my webcam.
Right. Yeah. It's just and, communal, right?
Yeah. Right. And it gets to, it's like, you know, I mean, one of the things that I was, you know, I wanted to talk about too was the fact that these viral campaigns and some of these, you know, marketing ad, they're fed to you. And the fact that, you know, yeah, I got a Coke can. Anybody can get a Coke can. It's almost like, well, if you're going to do augmented reality, maybe you should, you know, find the product, not just go to the grocery store and pick it up and put it in front of your can. So, but I mean, that's one of the things too. It's just that it seems lately everything is fed to you. There's no searching anymore.
Yeah, you know, I think marketers are, you know, they're concerned. I mean, they it's interesting because I think, you know, there's a definite. There's still a question of a lot of marketers will question the success of things. So, for instance, I don't think anyone questions the success of the District 9 program or, say, the paranormal
activity,
yeah, campaign. But I do think that you look at something like, you know, the stuff they're doing for Tron, let's say, or you know, Dark Knight, or even like we did some work for Terminator Salvation. You go like these are big properties, and they have a lot of people who are interested in them already. And you go like, are we doing something that's just capturing, that's just entertaining people who are already going to go see the film, or are we doing something that's actually reaching audiences and getting them to know about something at first? You know, I prefer if for doing this kind of thing, I actually prefer properties that are not known. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I thought was great about True Blood is it was a series of books, but I think for most people outside of the demographic of people who are reading those books, it was this new thing that was being introduced to them for the first time. And I think like Blair, I feel like this kind of thing works best when you're introducing something new and fresh. It doesn't mean that I don't think they shouldn't do things for the bigger films. The irony is that the big budgets come for the big films, right? I mean, if you're, you know, you're not going to and I think we see that in terms of, you know, Paranormal Activity has an interesting little campaign that that's really successful, but it's definitely kind of very focused and narrow in a way. Right. Whereas you see, you know, the bigger films get huge budgets, and they're, you know, they get to do kind of lots of big PR stunts and things like that. So yeah,
it's almost to the point where it's, you know, those are the films that, you know, like you said, they don't need viral campaigns, so yet they had the money for it. So it's kind of, it's almost ironic.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are, you know, to me, I think some interesting film, like Sherlock, to me, is an interesting film for something like this because you have a well-known character, but you're doing something different with that character in this film. So there's an opportunity to take a character that I think most people go, oh, well, I know what that's all about, and then give them a flavor and go, oh, maybe I don't know what that's all about, and get them excited about this new take on it. So, you know, so I do think there are times when it's good for a property. But at the same time, I do think it's also, you know, if they're making another Superman movie, I can't imagine why they would do a Superman viral.
Sure.
You know?
Well, and again, you talk, you know, when you bring up Sherlock Holmes, their current is through the Facebook, where you basically team up with a friend and one's Sherlock and one's Watson. How do you feel as far as the social networking? You know, how's that role? As opposed, I mean, I guess you can go two ways. You can do social networking as in find it, or you can do social networking as in here it is, spread the word. I mean, is it something that where it's helping a lot, or?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly helps. I mean, you know, a thing like even a thing like Sherlock, which is you know, essentially a two-person game, and it's something that, you know, two people can experience and on their own terms and in their own time together is interesting. It's very different from the more, you know, kind of mass community type things that go on. But, I think one of the reasons we're just seeing it on Facebook is simply because, you know, Facebook just announced they have 350 million people on it. So, you know, the population of Facebook is like the United States. Yeah. It makes sense. If you're going to do something like that, go ahead and do it with Facebook, you know, versus, say, Twitter, where I think most of the stuff we see on Twitter is connected to something larger.
Mm-hmm.
Like the web. So, yeah, I mean, having done programs that use Facebook in a very limited way and having done them where it relies on Facebook in a strong way, a lot of that to me depends on who we're trying to reach. Mm-hmm. And where are they and what are they doing, you know? So I think in the case of Sherlock, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's an easy way to get people to get to connect their friends. I mean, you know, the process of getting a friend to participate has been difficult, and Facebook Connect makes that easier. So in a way, Facebook is what makes, you know, what allows someone to sit back and go, hey, let's do a game where two people play together. And only two people, you know, and it's not about forums and lots of people figuring things out. So I think it's interesting. I'll be curious to see how effective it is once it's all, you know, played through.
That's true. I've never actually looked at it that way of, you know, two people figuring it out, because you always kind of, I think one of the fun things about viral marketing is when you find it first. And, you know, when you're part of a forum and you're part of communities and somebody else gets it before you, it's kind of like,
get mad.
a little kick in the pants and stuff like
it's
that.
Competitive. So, yeah. It becomes a competitive thing. Yeah, the storytelling component, obviously, I mean, the whole thing's just, Cloverfield is a great example. They're telling a story, but there's an extremely competitive part to it. And I think that's something that you really need to tap into, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's in a weird way, I think it's competitive, but I think it's less competition and more community dynamics, right? I mean, in a way, it's like in certain cases, you know, solving a puzzle or figuring something out first is in a sense elevating your status in a community. And there's a lot of different motivations for people to get involved. And there is a certain group of people where that's a key motivation. I think there's another group of people where a key motivation is a little bit of the ability to role play and play in a world that is a bit of a fantasy.
Right.
And, you know, I think there's another group of people that are really in love with the idea of connecting and communicating with characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and having that experience. And so I think, you know, designing something that allows people to connect with something in the way that they like, in the way that they enjoy, is the best way to do it. You know, I always say we try to structure our program so that it appeals to a wide variety of people. And oftentimes I say, you know, some people will think they've experienced the whole program, but they really haven't. What they've done is they've experienced the parts of a program that most appeal to them.
Right.
And they don't even see or recognize the other things that are going on. And that's okay.
Yeah, that's even an issue for us sometimes where we're trying to cover things. And, you know, it takes a lot of motivation for us to cover something that we just don't care about. You know, I think that's even happened. A great example, a great example is the movie Nine, where, you know, there was some anticipation for the film, but for their viral campaign they had, it was a little maybe too complex as well, but it was something where there just wasn't a lot of motivation to follow it step by step for us to cover it that much. So we, you know, we covered enough so that people could follow it themselves. But I mean, we kind of backed off a little bit from that. Whereas something like, you know, 2012 or District 9, obviously we were in the thick of it. So it's definitely, even from us as reporters or writers standpoint, you know, it even comes down to that for us too.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you know, and the question then is of course, is the campaign for Nine badly executed, and is that why you didn't care for it? You know what I mean? Or is it that for some reason you're just, you know, or is it just not a movie that you're interested in at all in the first place? You know, that's kind of
different
right. Yeah, it's true too, because of, you know, I mean, you look at the time that it was released, you know, you had District 9 was just around the corner and things like that. So it almost gets to the point to where, you know, not to play favorites, kind of a, you know, a situation, but you almost do. You say, okay, well, this one's a little more interesting, so I'm going to head that route, and I want to talk about it. I want to participate in it, and you forget about the others.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I always say that a lot of times it does come down to execution, right? I mean, I think it's possible. I think it would be possible to make a viral campaign for, say, you know, a soap opera, and have somebody who's really into hard action movies and sci-fi movies really be interested in what's happening. You know, I think there's a way to do that. I mean, the question, it comes down to the quality and the story of the quality of what you're doing and the story that you're telling and how you reach out to people. I think sometimes too, and that's where you get into the, you know, a lot. A lot of times, like it's one thing to say mailing stuff to people, right? Like we go, and a lot of times when you see something that's kind of boring and it's mailed out, or it feels like, oh, that's been done before, they go, oh, when are people going to stop mailing stuff to people? Mm-hmm. But the truth is mailing stuff to people can work every single time if what you're mailing is really interesting, you know? Right. If it's really interesting, people want to receive it. It's not something that becomes old. It becomes old when people do it badly, or when they do the same thing, or when they mail things that are uninteresting, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, that was, again, I mean, that's basically the way that you had started the True Blood. Like you said, you sent out those mailings, and it's, you know, I've always looked at things like as a physical, you know, part of the campaign as, I don't know if it's so much the best part of a campaign, but obviously that can pique the interest. Like you had said, if it's something interesting, you know, if it's just an ad or something like that that shows up in the mail, big deal. But again, you know, a stamped, you know, the wax stamp letter with, you know, illegible writing is huge.
Well, you know, the physical things connect us more. I mean, one of the things about online, as great as it is, you know, the idea that we can get on forums and we can communicate, we can, you know, tap into a community working together, and they have so much power and the ability to crack codes and break puzzles and solve mysteries together in a way that, you know, two people alone can't. And that's really interesting. But for all of that, and for all of that communication that goes on, there is something about a live event or something physical coming into play, because mm-hmm. it makes it, in a way, it electrifies it, because you're still, you know, even though we have community on forums, it's still mediated by the screen and the keyboard. You know, it's not even as immediate as us here now talking on Skype, you know. And all of a sudden, when you have a live event and some people get together and experience something together, or when something, some physical piece of the story all of a sudden ends up in your hands, it becomes electric. And it becomes electric not just for the people who receive the physical thing too, but it becomes electric for the people who know the people who receive the physical thing, you know, mm-hmm. in a way. And I think that's incredibly powerful, and I think it's essential. I mean, we did a short brief program for Discovery Channel Shark Week over the summer called Frenzied Waters, and we sent out these capsules that looked like they had been floating in the ocean for years, and you open them up and they smelled musty, and inside they have the remnants of a shark attack that they kind of had, like, you know, in one case there was a life vest that had a big bite taken out of it and had some dried blood on it, and had it had like this little container, and you open it up and it had a look like an old black and white picture of a girl with a note written on the back. And, you know, as you start to look at the pieces, you go like, oh, this was actually a World War II, you know, airplane pilot who was shot down over the Pacific and then, you know, landed in the water and then was attacked by a shark. And that's the kind of a story that comes out of this, and the whole thing linked to a website. And part of that was, you know, we're trying to play with the idea of scary and shark attacks, and, you know, how do you make people scared of a shark when they're sitting in front of their computer?
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you bring it to life in a really unique way, and physical, you know, physical props are one way to do that.
Definitely.
Right. And when you go that route too, you're sending out these, you know, pieces, these artifacts, you know, physical things. Do you get to the point to where you're almost like, okay, if we go this route, people might think it's real. Do we go this route, people might say, you know, whatever, it's Shark Week. You know, is there like a middle ground?
Yeah. Well, you know, we knew because, We did a combination of, we sent the capsules out to some people, but we also hid a bunch of capsules throughout the United States, and we released coordinates so people could go find them themselves. So in that sense, I think right off the bat, we didn't kind of identify Shark Week right away, but people knew we were telling a story for something.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and most people right away assume Shark Week, because the focus on sharks, you know, but Yeah, so in that case, it wasn't about, like, I don't think any of it mattered. You know, we could have come right out and said Shark Week from the beginning, and I don't think it would have mattered, and I don't think it would have taken away from the effect of it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because we've seen things, too, that are fed right to us. We know what it's for, but we're still going to follow it because we're interested in the story. But
right.
Now, you know, if you say, you know, move into the future of marketing, I mean, is the viral campaign going to spread? Is it going to show up in a newspaper to maybe, you know, affect more than those that are the usual, you know, suspects of following a viral campaign or, you know, the ARG? Is it going to try to, you know, branch out and get a little more?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a way, I think a good one does. And I think a good one actually branches out in ways that a lot of people might not even recognize that it's part of a deeper story. You know, when you start to see, like, you know, take in District 9, the bus benches.
Right.
You know, or even in True Blood when they did the ads for the True Blood beverage. Mm-hmm. You know, the posters and things. It's like, you know, there's a lot of people who walked by a bus bench and saw that thing and went, oh, that's pretty strange, and then moved on and never knew that it was connected to this online story and never visited the websites but kind of connected it to the movie. And I think that's okay. That's okay for those people who aren't, you know, there are a lot of people who only experience these things by being told about them from their friends, or they read about the wrap up on your site or another site, you know, and I think that's okay. You know, it's the idea, though, to me, is like, it goes back to that thing we were talking about, Alice. You know, I saw this guy walking around New York last week in a suit and a bunny hat, and I had I saw this thing and it made an impact because I came home that day and I told my kids about it, but I had no idea it was connected to Alice.
Yeah.
So I look at that and I go, wow, that's a real missed opportunity, because it was something that was connected to something deeper, but I wasn't able to make the connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's always, you know? That's always a problem with viral campaigns. You know, I mean, you do things like, you know, you want to make it subversive, but you also want to make sure people know what it's for. So I think with the District 9 ones, you know, they had the website, and then when the movie, by the time the trailers had come out and stuff, I think people connected. There was enough time, especially, to kind of connect it. Whereas I think something with Alice is a great example. That happened, what was that, Friday?
Yeah, it happened Friday.
Friday morning, yeah.
Yeah, Friday morning is when it happened, and it was on Sunday is when it premiered. So, you know, it's something where it's, you know, if you don't know, there's not enough time for you to go, oh, man, it's like, okay, well, it was already on. So if you didn't already know about it, it's like a little late. Whereas I think that's the one good thing about movies is that you have that opportunity to do it way in advance with all these trailers. So that
But also that's about thinking about each piece and what the experience is for people in each piece, right? Because there's a couple ways you can do this. You can treat your program like a puzzle, and you can break the pieces up and you can spread them around. And if I'm walking down the street and I see one puzzle piece, I go, okay, well, whatever with that, and I walk by it. Right. And I make no connection and I have no experience of it myself. Whereas if you're working to put together the puzzle piece, you see it and you go, oh, I need that, and you consume it, right?
Right.
Versus, like, say, District 9, when I walked by the bus bench, okay, and it said, you know, humans only, and it had D9.com, and like even if I didn't visit the site, I what I did was I got the words District 9, and District 9 is a place where humans and alien creatures are separated, right? And at the end of the day, that's really interesting, because then when I did see the trailer, it was like, oh my God, that bus bench, you know,
right, exactly.
And I was able to make this connection that was that was really interesting. And so and had I just walked by the bus bench, I still got an experience that kind of gave me a taste of District 9, even if I didn't dive in. Whereas seeing the rabbit didn't give me anything. There wasn't enough there for me to go on to have an experience beyond, well, there's a guy dressed as a rabbit. You know, I mean, it's funny enough, I'm walking the same streets where there's a guy who every once in a while I see him, and he's dressed like the most amazing pimp you've ever seen. So, you know, it's New York. It's like in a weird way.
You just assume someone's just acting weird.
Well, I thought he might be going to some kind of crazy party.
Yeah.
It didn't even occur to me that he was promoting anything.
Right.
That's how far removed it was from, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how, like, you know, you think of it to the average person, you know, you explain to them what they did for Alice, you explain to them that component of District 9, and some people just look at that and go, oh, they did the same thing, or, you know, they did something very similar. But especially, like you're just saying, the experience is what makes them different. You know,
yes.
it's how that affects the person, because if you're able to do something like that, where you're able to personalize it for each person, you know, to make them make those connections, and to a very surface degree, it's interactive.
Right.
That's enough to kind of get someone to at least, you know, with so many movies that are out there and so much noise, to if you can break through like that, that's what makes it all
yeah.
worth it.
And curiosity does that. You know, mm-hmm. curiosity, and I kind of look at it as like you give people an experience that gives them a story to tell, you know? And like one of the things that happened in True Blood was people in New York were trying to get people to sign petitions for the Vampire Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. You know, so you got someone sitting there and they got to sign for the Vampire Rights Amendment. And they stand up, they hand you a flyer or whatever. That's kind of interesting in a way that you're like, well, somebody tried to get me to sign a petition for a Vampire Rights Amendment, and I've got this thing. You know, you kind of go, what the hell is that all about? Yeah, and not only that, but it makes you curious enough. You know, if you're at all interested in vampires or what these people were trying to do, it makes you curious enough to follow up, to go right. on to the website and see what that's all about. You know, that kind of thing can work really well, or it can be done really badly.
I can imagine, you know, being approached by somebody in, like you said, the streets of, you know, New York, where people are usually dressed like rabbits, to where, you know, how much of it are you actually going to buy if somebody hands you a petition, so...
Well, you know, in all fairness, I read that the rabbits were handing something out, and I saw it. I didn't get close enough to get handed something. So, you know, in that sense, I think had the rabbit handed me something, I might have been much more intrigued. But
sure.
I'm willing to bet too that had I gotten handed something, I don't know. It may, you know, might have been interesting. It would have been interesting to see what they would have handed me that would have made me curious, or would they have handed me something that made me go, "Oh, let's watch Alice on Sci-Fi Sunday night,"
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah,
to see how deep it goes.
Yeah. So it, you know, it's it, without, you know, giving things away or, you know, projects that are currently being worked on. I mean, as far as Campfire goes, what I would assume you've got to be doing different avenues every day. You've got to be looking at different ways to promote, different ways to lead. You know, we had written an article maybe a week or two ago about the lack of viral on cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, and it gets to the point to where, I made a mention of, is it the lack of viral, or is it the fact that it costs the user? You know, obviously you're dealing with something a little bit more cost worthy than just throwing it out there. You know, so is it different aspects, things that are always being worked on, things that are tested and failed and vice versa? So,
yeah, you know, there's it's interesting because I think there's a variety of reasons why, but I think one of the biggest reasons, in particular in terms of marketing, is that behind the scenes, marketing budgets are often siloed. Like, I can't tell you how many times a company will come to us and they want to do something, and they've got some other company making their mobile app already, and they've mm-hmm. got some other company doing this, and they've got some other company doing that. And so you end up kind of looking at what channels or areas they haven't yet figured out what to use, and you kind of incorporate them. It's rare that, and that's kind of what I was saying about the difference between Blair, whereas in Blair, everything we did was kind of made a choice by us, and it was, we decided that everything would fit into a Bible in a way of here's the Bible for the experience. And even things that came after the movie, like there was a series of young adult novels, and there was a mm-hmm. series of comic books and PC video games, they all had to feed into this Bible, so they all kind of extended the story. Whereas I think you see, you know, even I think you could probably download, I'll bet you, for a lot of these virals, there are iPhone apps that are connected to them, and they're not mm-hmm. at all connected to the actual story of the campaign. And that's
correct.
Because the marketers are not yet recognizing, unfortunately, that a story can make everything that much more powerful. If you see, and that goes back to the bus bench thing, right? Like if what they're afraid of is they don't want to spend the money making a crazy iPhone app that, unless you're following this deep campaign, you're not going to understand what it does. But mm-hmm. if you can figure out a way to make an iPhone app that, if all I do is download the iPhone app, I get an experience for whatever it is you're promoting, and that's all I have to get in order to get the message, mm-hmm. but that iPhone app, if used in conjunction with the story, makes everything better. It makes the app better. It makes the story better. You know, right. That's what's really needs to be figured out. And I think that when it's done right like that, it can be incredible. It makes the iPhone app that much better, or the mobile app that much better. It would make the website better. It would make the experience better. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of these marketers, they tend to have their budgets siloed, and they don't think to go to one company to get all of that kind of done together. It's getting better, and we're starting to see more marketers be smart about, you know, working with their different agencies. But a lot of times that's what happens. You get one agency that does TV spots and another agency that does guerrilla marketing and another one that does digital, and you end up getting pieces that are not connected, and it's frustrating to the person experiencing it, because you know, even though you know, the truth is you may have examples where the marketer who's in charge of a online campaign that's a story might actually be a different marketer working for the same company that's responsible for the mobile app. Mm-hmm. You know, it's literally that, and sometimes they're not even working in the same building. You know, and so you sit there and go like, but to you, people experiencing these campaigns, they don't know that. Exactly. To them, it's just, here's this missed opportunity, and it's frustrating that these aren't connected. So clients have to get better. You know, the studios and the TV networks have to get better at, and have to be willing to try it, you know, to try doing those, to connecting these things better.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you guys would like to do, like, as far as like the iPhone apps? Because that sounds like a really cool thing, because I've seen, you know, 2012 had an iPhone app, but it had absolutely nothing to do with their viral campaign. And, you know, but to see something where they could find a way to integrate that, you could really make some really interesting choices. Because again, like you said, you know, you can download an iPhone app for free, and then you just get the updates, whatever. So, is that something where you guys would, you know,
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've definitely got some things out in the works that may very well be connected in that way. You know, it takes a special client to do that. I mean, you know, on a very basic level, you think about that. You know, 2012 had, I have no idea how many people were following 2012 actively, but I imagine it was a lot. There were a lot of people. Right. So let's just, you know, I'm just going to throw out a number that's probably not rooted in reality at all. I'll say, like, well, let's say 100,000 people were following that campaign. Well, if you had 100,000 people that you were entertaining for months and months and months, and then you release an iPhone app, and those 100,000 people will know about it right away, and they'll start downloading that app. That app is going to shoot up in the iPhone app ranks. People are going to notice it. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, your iPhone app will now get attention and will be seen by people who never stumbled on the campaign any other way, except that they are constantly looking for new apps on iPhone. And then, you know what I mean? And like, the more connected these things are, the more well thought out they are, the more they add. So instead of having an iPhone app over here and this viral campaign over here, if they're connected, the viral campaign feeds into the iPhone app, and then the iPhone app turns around and feeds into the viral campaign, and both become more successful as a result. And that's usually what we see what I see and recognize in the best marketing campaigns.
Obviously, I would assume that you know, you use the term program, because program has different, you know, ways that it can go depending on, you know, different keystrokes and whatnot like that. I mean, those are obviously things that you're looking at from the start when you put these together. So,
I mean, story is a powerful way to organize in particular, a complex campaign. You know, complex program, and story drives. Story is how we get an emotional connection. You know, story is what can make you go from, oh, that's kind of cool, to, oh my God, there's an iPhone app, I'm going to download that thing right now. You know, gets people passionate about things, and it doesn't take much to actually link these things, and oftentimes all it takes is thinking about the story and planning that layer. It doesn't even have to be done by one agency, I often say. You know, in fact, if you look at True Blood, there were a lot of agencies involved in True Blood doing a lot of different aspects of it, but everything all the agencies were doing was tied into this story of that was happening in to introduce season one, and so everybody was kind of working off of that timeline. So that timeline defined when the thing thing you were making was going to be released, and it defined what it is that you should make. So instead of having, you know, the guys in house at HBO who make videos for HBO to promote shows just go off and make whatever. Oh, let me go interview Anna Paquin. They were able to get this thing and go, okay, we're going to make these videos here that'll help bring this part of the world to life, you know. And other agencies are able to come in and go, okay, we'll do these things, and that'll help, you know, build that. It's in a way, it's an organizing principle for a program, and it means that there were agencies, even though we developed the prequel narrative and the story and handled a lot of the you know, almost all of the character writing and an awful lot of the video, it meant that there were agencies that we didn't even communicate with that were able to actually make things that were part of the program and that fit perfectly well. So, you know, it just takes that going to the right people to design the story and the architecture of the program first, and not getting other agencies creating things before you've got that architecture and the plan set up.
Like your Bible, sort of. You know, like this is, everything's based off this. Because that's the thing, is like you're trying to, you know, make a collaborative event, and if everyone's doing their own thing, it's almost impossible.
Yep, totally. And what's crazy is it makes things easier. It actually, I think for a marketer, I think if you actually have kind of, here's a program architecture and a timeline and a story, it actually gives you something to go and it actually is opportunity. Right. You know, it's your other agencies are going to be way more creative if they're working off something like that. I think that everything will be connected in a way that's deep. And I think the audiences will see it and they'll be impressed. You know, a lot of times your experience of how you perceive a movie is oftentimes based on how you perceive the pieces of marketing that you interact with beforehand. I'm guessing that because of your disinterest in the marketing for Nine, you probably don't have much interest in seeing the movie when it comes out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's another component to it when it comes to that kind of thing. You have to, a great example is Star Trek. I mean, there was a viral campaign for that, and I didn't really care much for it. But that was more, I think, just because it was so complicated. It was very complicated and very, I found, disorganized. And then it was just so too much. There was way too much you had to be able to do, like skill level. I think to really kind of figure things out into, you know, and I felt it was like just too much for someone. You know, the whole point of the film also, it kind of goes against the concept of the film. The film is like, you know, this isn't your father's, you know, Star Trek. This is not the geeky techno babble Star Trek. This is the action packed, you know, next generation, I guess you'd say, Star Trek. And so to do something that was very kind of almost geeky in the viral almost went against that whole philosophy. So I think that's something that for me, like, the movie was great and I watched the movie and I enjoyed it. And that really had nothing to do with the viral. It's just got to the point where you just kind of ignore it. You're like, oh, they have a viral. Okay.
Well, you know, but part of that too may have been, you know, at some point someone may have said, gee, you know, this movie is really different from the other Star Trek movies. It's more action oriented. I mean, the truth is it was the first Star Trek movie I went to in years, you know. I think Search for Spock, the Voyage Home, right? The one with the whale. I think that was the last one that I went to in the theater until this one. And so it's possible that they may have said, you know what? It's like, you know, Star Trek has a deep and loyal fan base and we don't want to dishonor them.
Right.
I, you know, I'm just taking a guess here. It wouldn't surprise me if they said, let's do something for those fans.
Right. I could see that, definitely.
Yeah, it's possible.
It just makes it's interesting when you know you're trying to, again, that's something where you're not, you know, you're trying to cater to a certain audience, and in films that have a lot of, almost to a certain degree, you could use the term baggage, but you could also use the term, there's a lot of different terms, like positive version of baggage, you know, like that fan base or whatever. You know, you
history.
History, you know, you have to, that's something you have to take into consideration. So a lot of films that we saw, especially this year, had that. I mean, sure, there are your District Nines and even 2012, which didn't have any kind of backing to them. But you had your Terminator, even now with Sherlock Holmes. You know, these are things that have something. People know something going into these films, and so you have to like take that into consideration when you're doing those kind of things. And sometimes even with something as like Terminator, you have an actual history you already have that you have to worry about. So that's always interesting. That's where you almost have to kind of play towards the fan base when you're doing, you know, franchise movies or movies that are based off material that people already know.
Or you have to move a fan base that feels very strongly about something because what you're doing might be changing it up. Like in the case of Star Trek, where you know you have a fan base that's not just very loyal but feels very intensely about things. And when you have a fan base that feels very intensely about something, and you go and you shake things up and you change it, that's just naturally upsetting to people.
Right.
So, sometimes you need to engage them in a way to kind of bring them along and make them go, come on, this is going to be good. You know, it's like,
and so
there's different ways of doing that. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's always about what are you communicating, and do you have a purpose, and what's the strategy? Who are you trying to reach, and what are you trying to say?
Right. Is that what you guys do when you guys, start out? Obviously not something with Blair Witch where it was very organic, but now that you're able to, you have more knowledge and you have more structure, is that something you initially think of as like, who is our audience? Is it our 18 to 35 males, or do you guys look at it like that when you do these?
Yeah. Well, we look at it even deeper. I mean, you definitely look at, I mean, most movies, studios, unfortunately, I think most marketers, they'll say something like, they'll have some weird, it'll be whatever. You can imagine, take the most weird movie. Oh, we've got, a David Lynch movie. And they'll go like, well, it's a David Lynch movie and it's got a lot of, sex and violence, but we really see this as a four quadrant movie. When they say that, they mean like all people are going to be interested in seeing this movie, right? It's like, to movie marketer who spends millions of dollars getting a movie in theaters, almost all their films, in their opinion, are films that are designed to appeal to all audiences. It's rare that a movie marketer would go, this is for sci-fi people. In fact, a lot of times what happens, you'll see, is they have a sci-fi movie, and instead of saying, this is a sci-fi movie, they go, this is a sci-fi movie, but we want to position it as an action film.
Right.
Or something like that, because they're afraid of marginalizing it in a genre or something is what they'll say. But yeah, so what we do is we take kind of what a studio or a network will say about a film, like, here's who we want to reach. And then what we'll do is we'll do something that's a little bit more anthropological, which is like to go and say, okay, where are these people? What are they doing? How are they behaving? Where are they going? Not just online, but offline. What do their lives look like? And then we look at the movie or the TV show or game or whatever it is we're promoting, and we say, what is it about this game or movie that intersects with the way these people are living their lives? And that intersection is where we try to tell the story.
Hmm.
So it very much starts with the people we're trying to reach, and then goes from there. And sometimes you have different levels. Like, you create certain things that are designed to reach a certain group of people. And so for instance, we're developing a program for a video game right now. And we have certain levels that are designed for the kinds of people that go to video game blogs all the time and read all that stuff and follow everything and go to GameStop. And then you've got another layer that's designed to be for people who have like video games but aren't so deeply passionate about it.
Right.
So you want to hit those people in different places, because if all you're doing is going to the same video game group of people, you're just marketing to the choir, and that's not necessarily what you want to do, although you do want the choir to be deeply engaged.
Right.
So yeah, it's definitely, it always is about who you're marketing to.
With that, do you you mentioned the fact that you guys did mailers, both for the True Blood and what was the other thing you mentioned?
Oh, Discovery Channel.
Oh, sorry, yep. Yeah, the Shark Week. So, Shark. How do you choose who to mail it to?
So that goes to oftentimes who we mail to, in both cases, very different people. And that often comes down to a matter of a couple of things. We go, like, first of all, what are we saying, and who are we saying it to, and what kind of story are we telling, and who is most likely to be into the story? So in the case of True Blood, we both did our own research and compiled our own list of people who had online properties in some way, whether they were a blogger or somebody who has a YouTube channel or somebody who has a podcast or somebody who is talking to an audience, whether the audience is small or big. It does, it's less about whether they have a huge audience, because you know, 1,000 people with a small audience makes a pretty big audience versus mm-hmm. like 10 people with large audiences. And sometimes you get more passionate people that way. So it's identifying people who have expressed an interest in, say, with True Blood, either, you know, gothic fiction, vampire movies, horror movies, you know, that kind of thing, and starting with them. So we both identified people who have audiences and are into that kind of thing. And then we also did, we purchased the mailing list of the subscribers, so the subscribers of Fangoria Magazine. Hmm. So if you subscribed to Fangoria Magazine, you know, that meant your way into horror movies. And then if you had any kind of a blog that expressed an interest in gothic fiction or even gothic music, you know, it was kind of more about a culture that was predisposed to be into vampire stories.
Right.
There was a good chance that you ended up on our radar and you got a mailing. Whereas with Shark Week, it became about, like, had you expressed anything online, or are you a diver? Do you go to the beach a lot? Do you know what I mean? It was like it kind of went in that way. It was about trying to identify the certain people, again, with an audience.
Right.
Because, you know, in a mailer like that, what you're really doing is you're giving people a story to tell, and they need to have people that they're going to tell that story to.
Exactly. That's really smart.
Yeah, so it's basically, you know, again, you send it as a diver, that diver's got diver friends and so on and so on, and it, you know, it starts to spread and stuff. So yeah, that was always the one thing too that we, you know, we look at, and I think on one of the video that you have on the site on campfirenyc.com, you have a video as far as the True Blood, and I think actually you know, the clip is from one of the blogs that, you know, everybody follows. It's, you know, what are these strange markings on these mailings, kind of a thing. So it's, you know, it's,
right.
It's always interesting to see how they get out there and who's getting it. Again, you got something as blatant as District 9 that puts a banner up at Comic-Con, and then you come down to more of that personal level with True Blood and, you know, a waxed, you know, stamp mailing. That. So it's interesting to just see how it's played upon with each campaign.
Yeah, and it also depends on what phase of the program you're in, right? I mean, to a certain extent, it's you know, are you kicking it off? And in the case of True Blood, the first month was really about getting people who we thought were predisposed to be into the show True Blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not about going wide and going big. And it was kind of like the first month, and truth was like, if you were the kind of person that didn't really express any interest in vampires or vampire culture or vampire fiction or horror movies, then you weren't really a person we were targeting with that first, you know, part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a good chance that the first month of the program you never heard about it, you never heard about even the mailings, because you're not following any of the bloggers or podcasters or YouTubers that we sent that to. Whereas later, you know, as we got closer to the release of the film, doing things that were meant to be a little bit broader and reach more people, that might be where you came into the story. But mm-hmm. for people who are way into vampire, you want to get them in early, and you want to get to feel a sense of ownership and to also to engage with the story, because, you know, a social story needs people to make it work.
That's cool. Just aside, I was thinking about with your True Blood thing. A couple months ago, they had some energy drink company was actually making a blood potion.
Yep.
Is that something that you guys had ever considered, actually making True Blood an actual drink?
We did. Well, actually, I think that energy drink is being called True Blood, right? I mean, because I think HBO finally, I mean, for the first season, you know, that kind of thing is difficult to actually make happen. We talked to HBO about it, and HBO really wanted to get, you know, would have loved to have gotten an energy drink on the shelves at that time called True Blood.
Right.
but it's pretty difficult because, you know, you basically, there's a whole system for distributing drinks and getting space on shelves at bodegas and 7-Elevens and
right.
supermarkets. And it's not something you can do as quickly as most advertising campaigns are developed.
Hmm.
You know, it takes time, and it takes a dedication, and it's a whole different business, and it's very expensive. So I think what happened was, you know, after season two, or while season two was going on, what happens then is a drink company actually goes, hey, True Blood is really popular. There's value in putting out a drink, you know, that's called True Blood. So it kind of, like, in a way, because the show got popular, the possibility reversed. Right. It became like, oh, well, now there's value to someone. Whereas before, when nobody knew what True Blood was, it was like, you know, well, how much are you going to pay me to do this?
Exactly. That becomes almost viral in its own sense.
Yep, absolutely.
It's just interesting to see all the different ways that something, you know, can go out there and you know, whether it's just to tell a story or whether it's, you know, the little one-offs like these things. It's always interesting to see the different innovative ways that people have of promoting things.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, there's so much more opportunity when you're involved in a narrative. There's so much more opportunity and possibility and potential, you know, to create things that are really interesting and that kind of capture the imagination. You know, at the end of the day, you know, especially if you're promoting a movie or something, you have to make sure that the experience you're giving people in the marketing campaign is top quality and really captures the experience that they're going to have in the theater.
Right.
You know, and that's can be difficult to do, and so, you know, you got to make sure that the story you're telling in your marketing campaign is as credible as the story that they're going to see in the theater.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I mean, you're doing a film and you want to make sure that you know, like that experience that they're having, that it's going to be just as worthy of their time and their money. I mean, even though it's not money, it's time.
Absolutely.
Know, it's just as worthy as them spending that money in the theater.
Yep.
I mean, yeah. We've gone movies and TV shows, and you had mentioned, you know, I know Campfire's done some video game marketing and stuff. And again, Campfire is based on stories. So do you see books, publishers, you know, coming your way and saying, hey, here's my story. Maybe you can do a little prequel to that story to move into books. You know, books are something that you usually wouldn't see a campaign for, because it's a story in itself.
Yeah. You know, I think actually, to me now, I think the most interesting thing that I'm seeing happening in publishing is actually things that the author themselves are doing. Like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with an author named J.C. Hutchins, who has a website. You know, he's just actually, believe it or not, this is a guy who, in order to break in the publishing industry, took his first novel and released it as an audio podcast. And it became so popular that eventually a publisher picked it up and it just came out in the bookstores. But, you know, here's a guy who actually wrote a prequel to the novel to promote the novel and released it as an audio podcast and has done all kinds of incredible things with his website. And he's doing it all on his own. And so he's marketing it, but he's also creating he's also extending the world of what he's doing. And, you know, it's really smart, and it's the kind of thing that I think a natural storyteller like a novelist would do, whereas I think it's much harder for these publishers to wrap their heads around something like that. You know, I think it's easier for the movie companies to do it because they're used to developing stories, but I don't know, it seems like the publishers have had a harder time breaking into that world. So no, I mean, I would love, occasionally we've gotten some publishers, but you know, at the end of the day, the publishing budgets are also really tight. So they go, sure. You know, they spend most of their money doing things like they want to buy an end cap at all the Barnes & Nobles across the United States, and that costs a lot of money. But at the end of the day, they go, if I buy that end cap, you know, everybody who walks into a Barnes & Noble is going to see my book. And if I don't buy, if I spend the money on this campaign, how can I know that the people who you touched in the campaign are going to go to Barnes & Noble and buy the book? The answer is, well, it's unproven. We can't prove that right now. So it's going to take, you know, it takes a guy like J.C. Hutchins to come along and do it and promote himself that way and make it work and show that it can work. But it's still difficult for a publisher to commit that budget. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what we're going to see, like if you ask me about where this is going to go, I think what's going to happen and what really excites me more than anything else is the possibility that the showrunners, you know, the guys who actually run the shows and producers, the people who are actually making the movies, are going to start going, you know what, I'm not sure that the movie studio, now that this marketing is becoming more about the story, I'm not sure that maybe the studio or the marketers are the best ones to control that. And I think that we might start to see really smart producers start to collaborate. I'm waiting. The call that I want to receive is a call from a producer or showrunner who says, I've got a show and I want to do something really interesting to promote it that's steeped in the mythology of the show or that's mm-hmm. steeped in the story of the show, and to work with the people who are actually making the show to do it, but at the same time to bring that knowledge of marketing right. to the table, because it still has to work as marketing. It can't just be the show itself, you know? And that's where it's going to get interesting, because right now there's you know, marketers are the most – I give them a lot of credit because marketers are very experimental about it and they're willing to spend the money and try it, which is why we're seeing what we're seeing. But, you know, to really get great authentic stories that are truly connected to the films, it's going to take – it's eventually going to need to have the input of the producer and the filmmaker and the writer in that process. You know, and that's when I think things are going to get really exciting.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting too. Like you said, you know, have that person's—it's their story. Bring more of that, or you know, be a part of the actual prequel, the viral, the ARG, and things like that, and kind of just take it—not their own, but you know, again, just offer a little bit more insight. Because one of the biggest things that you know, my personal issue is, you know, when a movie ends, so does the viral. So you kind of want to see that producer, that writer, that director, that marketing firm. Carry it and still treat it. You know, I gave it this much respect at the beginning. I want to move it to the end as well. I want to keep it going. So
absolutely. And also that there's truly a connection, you know, like I think one of the great things, and this happens so too rarely, if you ask me, but one of the reasons the True Blood program was so great, I think, is because HBO sent the plan. They sent, you know, all the scripts we were writing for the videos in True Blood and what mm-hmm. we were doing was all sent to Alan Ball, and we got Alan Ball's feedback on it. And so it was like, you know, even before, like for season one, before the first episode was on the air, it was interesting to get feedback and to have him say, you know, oh, don't go near here because I'm going to be doing something with that later in the season. And this, I'd like you to kind of go in this direction. And what it meant, you know, what it meant was that the things that we were doing were actually meaningfully connected to the show,
mm-hmm.
you know, versus what happens too often, which is where, you know, the marketers don't ever get to speak. Even the marketers at the studios, like you'd be surprised. There's people who are responsible for marketing, you know, the Star Trek movie, and they never even get to sit in the same room with J.J. Abrams. You know what I mean? They you know,
yeah, we see that too with the viral campaigns. I mean, I remember in an interview, Neil Blomkamp, the director of District 9, said he had no part in the viral. And then I think Roland Emmerich also said he had no part in the 2012 viral. Mm-hmm. So these are the two people who, I mean, Neil Blomkamp actually, I think, wrote the movie as well. So I think Emmerich actually wrote 2012 as well, too. So, I mean, these are people who are the, you know, the basis for these stories. They're the driving force. And they have, like, literally no input in this really extensive, both of those were very extensive viral campaigns. Yet they had absolutely no input.
Yeah, and I think one of the, you know, good things. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would look at it, obviously, this is just my input, but I would look at the fact with True Blood is the fact that it's not a movie, it's ongoing. So it's almost like your vibe, I don't know if your campaign can hurt it. So the fact that, you know, that director's in there just wants, you know, it's nice to see that somebody wants to put their involvement in there and carry it forward. It's not just a show anymore, it's more.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the reasons why I asked you guys if you were going to cover TV shows more is it was interesting because you know, before we got started and you had said that you thought that the movies had the biggest budgets. And while they do, I actually think there's more potential for this kind of marketing in TV because TV is persistent, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if a show is successful, it comes back for season two and season three and season four, which means that there's an ability to create a whole connected universe associated with a show and have it exist even in between seasons. I mean, like, unfortunately, you know, you take a show like Lost, and I don't know that you could do it for Lost because of how deeply entwined intricate the mystery is. But, you know, I think there are shows where, you know, you could actually create a world that allows fans to kind of live and play and experience that world even when the show is not on first run, when the season's over and in between seasons, you know, and that's really powerful to be able to do that, to kind of keep people thinking about the story and keep them going online and then have it feed directly into the next season is huge. And that's a significant change in the way that TV marketing is done, because, you know, TV marketing typically is new season, new marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do? You know, so thinking about that, this idea that, well, now I can actually extend the experience of a TV show and have it live on and have it continue and have it build. So like all these people that I gather together for season one to do something, I don't have to send them away when the season starts and the marketing ends. I can actually keep them interested and engaged and then and build and have them bring more people in and more people in so that season two comes around. You know, you might amp things up even more, but when season two comes around, you're not only talking to the people that you were talking to in season one, but you're talking to many more people because it's grown
right
organically. You know, that's viral.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the concerns, though, is, you know, with a film, it's like no matter what happens, that film is released, and you know, and if, especially for a lot of these films we've seen this year have been big releases. And so, you know, the movie's going to come out, it's going to make its money, and so there's not much harm in doing the viral, whereas with a TV show, you could do this big build-up and maybe, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, it airs like two episodes and then, you know, cuts out.
Yeah.
You know, they cancel it. So I think that's the thing where I think especially when you look at the Office, they really started doing things at least after the first season. They might have even waited till the second or third season to start doing their web series and stuff.
Right.
I mean, I think that's something where you first have to see the reaction of people, and then you can kind of really start ramping it up, because to try to do that, I can't imagine many of the TV networks really wanting to put that kind of investment into a show that might just, you know, fizzle out in a couple episodes.
Right. Or think about it the other way, right? Like I sit there and go, man, if I was a development executive at a network, or heck, forget that, a movie studio too. If I was a development executive at a TV network, though, you know, pilots are not cheap when you commission a pilot. And you can imagine how many pilots get made and don't even make it on the air.
Right.
Forget about getting one or two episodes in the can and airing them and then canceling the show. There's so many more that are created and never make it to air. Mm-hmm. And I go, that's a lot of money and time and development work and people and resources that are spent developing ideas that you and I never even get to see. And I go, like, what would happen if you actually turned around and took a small piece of that money that you spend doing that and handed it to a showrunner, somebody who comes to you with a pitch for an idea, and you said, you know what? Start telling your story online. Start telling it online, and you know, no TV show. Start telling it online. Start getting people interested in your characters and the scenario you're spinning. And if you get, you know, 500,000 people and, you know, interacting with your story, engaging with your story, involved with your story, then – you know, I'll commission a pilot.
I mean, that's,
you know what I mean?
Idea.
Like that, you know, like it can work the other way too, where you can actually start. I think that it would be interesting to see things start that way and not, you know, I know that it's happened occasionally. There was, what was that, that college show that was on MySpace and then they put it on the air during the writer's and it failed. But I think that, you know, that was like a show that was rejected by the networks that they turned into webisodes. And then when people started watching the webisodes, they went on TV. And I think it was something where
doesn't work like that.
Yeah. You know, it kind of like, when then guess what? It failed on TV. Well, they rejected it. But this is something where, you know, you don't try to just make the TV show for the web. You do something really interesting and interactive that, you know, invites people into the world so that when the TV show starts, they can come in. I mean, we did that after Blair Witch. My partner Greg Hale and David Goyer, who wrote the Batman movies and is a director in his own right, is the showrunner for Flash Forward, developed a show called Freaky Links for Fox right after Blair Witch. Yeah. And there was a universe that was created for the show that was actually online for a year before the show went on the air, to the point where when Fox started running ads for the show, which only ran for one season, people were emailing the character of the website that was active, which was freakylinks.com at the time. They were emailing the character saying, you should sue Fox. They stole the name of your website and your story and have made a TV show out of it.
That's great.
You know, I mean, it's possible to build a rather large audience. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the TV show still has to answer for itself.
Yeah.
But I think it's possible to get people really interested right off the bat and not have it be the other way around where everything keys off of the show.
Right. That's a good idea. You know, make one less pilot and use that money for something else.
Yeah.
Figure all that money they spend on pilots. I mean, even some of these, I think they were talking about the Lost pilot was like $10 million or something like that. It's just like, it's crazy how much money they sometimes will spend on, you know, if they believe in it. So I guess it makes sense sometimes.
yeah. You know, but you know, if you took $1 million and you gave it to you split it up and you gave it to five talented showrunners and said start doing something online, engaging people with something and bringing them into the world, you could probably find out without people even knowing that it's connected to a TV show. You would just immediately find out, whoa, look, people are really gravitating towards this story. Let's make a pilot out of it. And then you have an audience that once they hear they're making a pilot, it's like, whoa, you got an audience of people who want to see it.
Exactly.
Sounds almost like those the old choose your own adventure kind of stories where you just build upon it as you go and see what happens at the end.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So with you guys, I know they did a Blair Witch sequel. Did you guys have anything to do with that in terms of the marketing?
No. not in terms of the marketing or the film, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
That was something the studio did on the heels of the success of the first movie. And, I think deep down inside, Ed, Dan in particular, but I mean, at that time there was no one really, I mean, Wired magazine existed, but it didn't really cover Blair Witch, and there weren't people like you guys following what's going on, and there was no real internet culture, or at least it wasn't being written about. So the story of Blair Witch ended up being, oh, you got to have a cool website to promote your movie. And people didn't really recognize that what was really happening there was that the story, we were building fans for the story before the movie came out. And, right. In a weird way, people never use the word fans when referring to all the people who were in love with the Blair Witch story before the movie came out. But that's what it really was. So I think even the studio that distributed the film didn't really kind of understand it. I think to them, because they didn't, they didn't create the mythology and the story that was what really engaged people. They used it to sell the movie, but at the end of the day, they didn't really understand that interaction because they weren't interacting with people. We were, so they didn't get it. So when they wanted to make a sequel, they were making a sequel that blatantly violated the mythology that we had already established. And we told them that. We said, look, this film blatantly, it basically turns its backs on the fans. And you're not going to have a success with that. And I don't think they didn't understand it. I think we were talking a completely different language with them, And so, they made that film. And it's not that a sequel wouldn't have worked. It's that sequel was destined to fail because it didn't honor the fans of the first film.
Yeah, that's why I never saw it.
I hear that they're remaking in another, I forget exactly where, I want to say like Sweden or Scotland or something like that. I hear they're remaking.
Well, that's not an official thing, I don't believe, no.
I imagine rumor mills that happen every year when stuff dies down, I guess, right?
It's some other filmmaker's viral campaign.
Like you said, your big thing for your company is telling stories. How hard is that to do with products? Because obviously, when you're doing a movie or a television show, there's already a narrative there. There's already a story. How hard is it? Is it easier because you're kind of starting from scratch, or is it tougher to create a story based for a product?
I actually think it's easier. I think it's easier because, for that very reason, is that you're not having to deal with characters and stories. And, a lot of times with movies, too, you have to be careful. Like, a movie has characters and studios and filmmakers are very protective of those characters. I mean, like, even in the case of True Blood, we didn't, in our campaign, we didn't have Sookie and Bill and, the main characters of the show in our campaign. We had other characters, peripheral characters that were involved in the campaign. And I think you see that a lot in these things. And it's because there is that separation between the marketing and the actual production and creation. And the marketers often are scared to kind of use a main character for anything because, they have to get permission from the filmmakers and whatnot. So I think it is hard. Whereas, like, we did a big program. There's a video on that same page. You referenced the video on our site for True Blood. Mm-hmm. There's a video there for a program we did for Audi called Art of the Heist. Mm-hmm. And that was one where the characters were created from scratch, and they were created to represent the brand Audi and the car that we were selling in a way, even down to like their personalities and what they were wearing. It was all very much thought through in terms of expressing something about Audi. And that it was much easier to develop that story than it is to kind of back into, oh, here's a film or here's a TV show, and we got to figure out how to fit in a story and not step on the toes of the people who are making the show that we're promoting, but at the same time have the audience feel like it's organic and it's a part of it.
Right.
Yeah. And I actually think for brands, there's a lot more opportunity to develop stories around their brand if they're willing to go there.
Yeah. I mean, you really have to kind of find some sort of creative link. Because, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a website called unfiction.com, which we...
Yes.
Has a you know, great form, horrible main page. And so, you know, we go there a lot of times too to try to get either, if there is a campaign going on, we're looking at what they found out. Sometimes they're our workhorse a little bit, and also, you know, I just go there looking for new things. But I mean, they cover every kind of viral thing, so you see that all that stuff there for, you know, the Levi's jeans that is doing a viral now, and the Butterfingers mm-hmm. is doing one. So it's really interesting to see, you know, these people are there and they're pretty interested in it, even though it's not a movie, it's not, you know, crazy sci-fi cool characters, it's, you know, but these are people that just, you know, part of it, they're able to create a good enough viral where people are getting interested in, you know, following something that's about a, you know, a candy bar.
Yeah, well, you know, in many ways, that's one of the reasons why I think story can be so powerful for brands, and I think smart brands are starting to figure that out. Is that, you know, a lot, there are certain candy bars that people, I think, have a relationship to. You know, I think there are certain people who feel like very passionately about their Snickers or their Reese's, right? And then there are other candy bars that are just like, oh, that's tasty. You know, I'm in the mood for one of those. And I think one way that you can kind of create a connection is by telling a story in some way, creating characters that are interesting that connect to it and make you think of the brand. You know, this goes beyond product placement, because you're actually, you know, as opposed to just like sticking a Butterfinger in Bart Simpson's hands, you're actually creating a character that expresses Butterfinger. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to describe without actually kind of going through and doing it, but it is possible. And then, you know, when you see that character, I mean, we see it in traditional advertising. We just haven't seen it taken into storytelling realm, right? I mean, like, you know, they've done it for kids. You know, you have Ronald McDonald. We see characters all the time that represent products, and they used in 30-second spots. But, you know, it in a way, you can make characters and you can tell stories for brands and get – and like in the case of Audi, I think, you know, by launching the car that way and telling that story the way we did, we made people really interested in the car who normally would not pay attention to a 30-second spot that showed a car driving on a beautiful cliff really fast, you know? So you can also reach people in surprising ways and pique their curiosity about your product in ways that they're not even, to a certain point, consciously aware. You know, I think in many ways what we did with Audi was we created a story that made people curious about the car, and that drove them to Audi's website to go look at how, you know, what is so special about this car? What's going on here? You know, and it made them interested in a way that I don't think would have been possible with just a 30-second spot or a print ad.
Right. Mike, I mean, I know you guys just won some awards recently.
Oh, yeah. I think the True Blood campaign won some. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's you know, it's nice. It's nice to be recognized.
Yeah, there's the IAB Mix Awards. So that's cool. You have the won 4 awards. So obviously these guys know what they're doing.
We try.
So for everyone listening, you can find out more about their company at campfirenyc.com. Watch True Blood on HBO. Great show. It's definitely a different take on a lot of things, and something that it lends itself very nicely, I think, because of all the, you know, mythology and everything, it lends itself to the viral very, very well. And that's I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
No, thank you. Very, very much appreciated, Mike. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
That was fun.